Welcome to this eViral Hepatitis Review Podcast. I'm Bob Busker, Managing Editor of the program. Our guest today is the author of our recent newsletter issue, Real World HCV Care. He's Dr. Andrew Muir, Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Gastroenterology at Duke University School of Medicine. eViral Hepatitis Review is jointly presented by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. This program is supported by educational grants from Gilead Sciences Incorporated, Merck & Company Incorporated, and AbbVie Incorporated. Learning objectives for this audio program include discuss the real-world data to support a sofosbuvir-letypivir treatment duration of 8 weeks versus 12 weeks, summarize the current hepatitis C treatment options for patients with advanced kidney disease, and describe the risks and benefits of hepatitis C therapies in HIV-HCV co-infected patients. Dr. Muir has disclosed that he has served as a consultant and/or advisor to AbbVie Incorporated, Gilead Sciences Incorporated, and Merck & Company Incorporated. He has also received grant and/or research funding from AbbVie, Gilead Sciences, and Merck & Company. Dr. Muir has indicated that there will be no references to the unlabeled or unapproved use of any drugs or products in today's discussion. Dr. Muir, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be a part of this program.
The publications you reviewed in your newsletter issue provided a lot of new and clinically important information. Our objective today is to help translate those findings into action. So if you would, doctor, please start us out with a patient presentation.
Our first patient is a 63-year-old African-American man with hepatitis C genotype 1A infection. He was diagnosed 1 year ago with a risk factor of injection drug use in his teens. He is HIV negative and does not have hepatitis B infection. FibroScan was performed and was 7.0 kilopascals and therefore not consistent with cirrhosis. And his hepatitis C RNA level was 4.5 million international units per mil.
HIV negative, hepatitis B negative. He's not cirrhotic. How would you approach individualizing this patient's treatment?
So for each patient, you really do want to take the approach of trying to figure out what is the best thing for this patient. And we're lucky right now that there are a number of treatment options, but there are some caveats that will impact that final decision. A key thing is the genotype. There's 6 main genotypes around the world. And then for genotype 1, there's 1A versus 1B. And we do see some slightly different approaches and response rates that we see with that. So that's very important. Another key factor is the degree of fibrosis. Every patient with hepatitis C needs to have their fibrosis checked, and that will sometimes impact the duration of treatment, but also impacts how we're going to follow them after treatment. The people with early fibrosis, we will treat and then actually be able to discharge from the clinic. The people with advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, we're going to follow for many years and make sure they don't develop other complications of liver disease. And once we know that the genotype and the fibrosis, then we can look at the different treatment regimens that are available and guide the patient. Sometimes the kidney function makes an issue as well, and that will be a factor. Sometimes if the patient has very advanced liver disease, that's going to impact some of the choices that we might make. And again, we are fortunate right now that we have a number of choices. And I will say the final thing that's really important is that the patient understands their hepatitis C, understands what's involved in taking a medication regimen effectively and being adherent to it, and we prepare them to be successful. And we do a lot of patient education along the way to make sure they understand their role in it and that we're supporting them so that they can be successful and be cured of their hepatitis C.
Potential medication regimens you might consider for this patient. Would one of them be letypivir/sofosbuvir?
Yes, that would be a very reasonable option for this patient.
Should this patient be considered for an 8-week treatment duration?
For this particular patient, I actually would not consider an 8-week duration. For many patients, that is a very appropriate duration. That decision about the 8 weeks versus 12 weeks came up for us when this medication regimen was approved. The FDA did an analysis and found that in patients who did not have cirrhosis and who had a hepatitis C viral load that was less than 6 million international units, that their SVR or cure rates were similar to patients whether they received 8 versus 12 weeks. And then that's where that came from. In subsequent analyses, though, we did find that for African-American patients in some of our real-world data sets, that we did not actually see the same response rates. It's a small but meaningful difference with a slightly lower response rate. And therefore, our ASLD-IDSA guidance panel made the decision to not recommend that we proceed with an 8-week regimen in that particular situation for these African-American patients. And so because this particular case has an African-American patient, we would not recommend the 8-week duration here and would recommend 12 weeks of sofosbuvir-letypivir.
Well, now, in your experience, Dr. Muir, have payers ever mandated specific treatment durations?
Yes, some payers do mandate the particular treatment and the duration. It varies, obviously, payer to payer, but I have seen that come up. And it can be challenging at times because we may have changes in our guidelines during the course of a year. And at that point, what the payer has mandated may no longer follow with the guidelines. So we have been in situations before where we've needed to work with payers, make the appropriate appeals. I find that those are successful when they're an evidence-based appeal, such as in the examples that we provided here with lower response rates, for example, with African Americans at 8 weeks. But it is something that really need to understand exactly what the payer guideline is and then react to it with the appropriate evidence.
What are some of the other factors that might influence your treatment duration decisions?
When thinking about treatment duration, it really is where we have to individualize that for our patient. And a number of things are going to affect it. It does come up with this 8-week duration for sofosbuvir lidivisvir. That question comes up for a lot of patients. And just as a reminder, 8 weeks is not appropriate if patients have cirrhosis or if their viral load is greater than 6 million international units per milliliter, or if they're African American, or if they have HIV. That group needs 12 weeks. When we're thinking about all the other regimens, then again, we think about the level of fibrosis. Patients with cirrhosis may need longer treatment. We think about if they've failed other treatments, that may impact how we approach them and their duration. And also, this is partly where, you know, it may not be exactly within the guidelines, but if a patient has multiple negative predictors, or perhaps they have a borderline fibrosis stage, maybe they're not exactly cirrhosis on whatever test you've done, but maybe you have an instinct that they are at increased risk for a lower response. Or again, maybe they're obese and near cirrhosis. And that's where I think clinicians have a role to make a decision about what's in the best interest of their patient. And those are some of the factors we want to consider, again, because we want to look at this individual patient and decide how can we best treat you? How do we offer you the best chance of cure?
Nicely said, doctor. And we'll return with Dr. Andrew Muir from Duke University School of Medicine in just a moment. This is Bob Busker, Managing Editor of eViral Hepatitis Review. eViral Hepatitis Review is a combination newsletter and podcast program delivered via email to subscribers. Newsletters are published every other month. Each issue reviews the current literature in areas of importance to hepatologists, infectious disease specialists, primary care physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, and other clinicians caring for patients with viral hepatitis. In the month following each newsletter, a case-based podcast discussion, like the one you're listening to now, is available to help translate that new information into clinical practice. These podcasts are also available as downloadable transcripts. Subscription to eViral Hepatitis Review is provided without charge or prerequisite. Continuing education credit for each newsletter and each podcast is provided by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. For more information on this educational activity, to subscribe and receive eViral Hepatitis Review without charge, and to access back issues, please go to our website, www.eviralhepatitisreview.org. Thank you. Welcome back to this eViral Hepatitis Review podcast. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Muir from Duke University School of Medicine, and we've been discussing how the real-world information he described in his newsletter issue can be translated into improved clinical practice. So if you would, doctor, please continue with another patient scenario.
Our patient now is a 44-year-old man with hepatitis C genotype 2 infection. He was diagnosed 6 years ago when he had progression of his chronic kidney disease and initiated hemodialysis. He is not planning to pursue kidney transplantation. He is HIV negative and hepatitis B surface antigen negative. FibroScan was performed and was 6.3 kilopascals and therefore not consistent with cirrhosis. And his hepatitis C RNA was 11 million international units per mil.
Individualizing treatment for patients with chronic kidney disease. What key factors need to be considered?
When patients have chronic kidney disease, that is really going to impact how we approach their hepatitis C treatment. And it's particularly important that we understand the level or stage of chronic kidney disease. And in general, for most of our regimen, it's going to be fine if they have one of the earlier stages. And I look closely at their GFR or glomerular filtration rate. If it's above 30 mils per minute, then we're going to be fine in general. Particularly with the sofosbuvir-based regimens, if they have a GFR less than 30 mils per minute or on hemodialysis, then those regimens are going to be problematic. We have not been able to determine a safe dose of sofosbuvir for those patients. And the good news is, in many cases, we're going to have other options. So that's really an important thing to first consider. Now, for these people with more advanced chronic kidney disease, and especially those on hemodialysis, it's also important to know if they're considering kidney transplantation. The access to kidney transplantation right now is quite curious in that patients may be able to receive a hepatitis C positive kidney. And while the wait for some patients on the kidney transplant list can be for many, many years, if they are willing and able to receive a hepatitis C positive kidney, their wait can actually be reduced significantly. So if you were to treat them and to clear their hepatitis C, you actually may impact their access to kidney transplantation. And so it's critical that before we start hepatitis C treatment in one of these patients, that we've had that conversation with the patient and probably with their kidney specialist to understand if this is something that they're considering. It's really critical that that gets determined. Now, once we figure all that, and let's say we are proceeding with treatment, well, again, the genotype's going to matter. We have different treatment options based upon it. This is especially important for the patients with chronic kidney disease who have the low GFRs. The sofosbuvir-based regimens will be an issue there, and it's going to be particularly problematic for the currently genotypes 2, 3, 5, and 6 because their current recommendation is to receive PEG interferon alpha and ribavirin. And then there's a number of our regimens that include ribavirin. Ribavirin is cleared by the kidneys. Therefore, they'd have to have a dose reduction in this, and they still are at risk for significant anemia. And so we need to make sure, what is their baseline hemoglobin? Can they tolerate it? And if we do proceed with a regimen that includes ribavirin, we're going to have to monitor them very closely. So a number of issues that will come up, but important to do, and we can manage them. It's just a matter of putting this all together and making sure that we've determined the right strategy for that patient.
I want to go back to the patient you described. 44-year-old male, genotype 2, HIV negative, hepatitis B negative, non-cirrhotic. He's on hemodialysis. What would your treatment recommendation for this patient be at this time?
My treatment recommendation today would actually be to defer treatment. And it's because he's genotype 2 and because he has the advanced kidney disease, then the best treatment for all patients with genotype 2 at this time is a sofosbuvir-based regimen. It's sofosbuvir-velpatasvir. But I would not want to give him the sofosbuvir. And if patients could not take that because of their chronic kidney disease, then the current ASLD IDSA recommendation is that that patient would receive PEG interferon alpha and ribavirin. This is the one remaining area of our treatment landscape where PEG interferon still exists. That's that weekly injection that has significant side effects and is a very different quality of life experience compared to the other direct-acting antiviral regimens. So unless I had a strong reason that I couldn't wait for treatment and I had to proceed now, I really would want to defer on this patient, especially because there will be treatment regimens that are available soon.
A hypothetical situation, doctor. Let's say this patient feels very strongly and he tells you, I'm not going to take interferon, but I want to be treated right now. Would you offer him sofosbuvir-velpatasvir?
Well, sofosbuvir-velpatasvir would be the current recommended treatment for somebody who had normal kidney function or an early stage of chronic kidney disease. And many clinicians have found themselves, I think, in this very situation you describe here, where a patient is very motivated and we want to help them. And there is some experience in our literature about treating patients with more advanced chronic kidney disease, including those on hemodialysis, with sofosbuvir-based regimens. As we discussed in this issue of the newsletter, the HCV Target Registry of Real-World Patients did look at this very issue, and they did find that the outcomes as far as efficacy were very similar for all stages of chronic kidney disease. And so, you know, you can see that this might be something that's very attractive. The concern, however, is that serious adverse events were more than 3 times higher in the patients with lower GFR or worsening kidney function. And when they looked at the patients who had more advanced kidney disease but were not yet on dialysis, they actually noted that worsening renal function occurred in that group. Now, this is a registry, and it's difficult to know exactly what was going on with those patients and say that the drug is responsible, but it's just a caution to us that there are issues with giving this particular medicine and those that contain sofosbuvir for this group of patients. And patients need to be aware of that. Their clinicians need to guide them as they make some of these decisions. And also, I think if you're talking to a patient about this right now, it's important for them to know that there will be another regimen that we expect to be available in late 2017. It's called lacaprevir, pibrentasvir. And it is a pan-genotypic, so it covers all the genotypes regimen, which means it's also going to work for patients with genotype 2 infection, like this patient, and it doesn't have renal clearance in large part, so therefore it would be a great choice for this patient. So that's why I said if my hand is not forced right now and the patient can wait, it's a good thing to wait.
Well, again, doctor, hypothetically, let's change this patient from genotype 2 to genotype 1B. Would that change your treatment recommendation?
Yes, my recommendation would be different. The genotype 1B patients have options available to them now that are quite effective. The genotype 1B patients also do not need ribavirins, so the risk of, and particularly of some of the hemolytic anemia and other adverse events are just not there. The current regimens of elbisvir, grazoprevir, as well as paratiprevir, boosted by ritonavir with ambidisvir and dasabivir, both are great choices here, and I have experience with them as well, and the studies show that in patients with advanced kidney disease, patients do very well. So you would not have the same kind of concern, and you'd be able to proceed with treatment at this time.
Well, thank you, Dr. Muir, for that case and discussion. Let me ask you now to bring us one more patient scenario, if you would, please.
The patient is a 51-year-old man with HIV and hepatitis C genotype 1A infection. He was diagnosed 4 years ago. He is on efavirenz, emtricitabine, tenofovir disoproxil fumarate with a CD4 count of 950 cells per mil and HIV RNA that is not detected. He has hepatitis B surface antigen and hepatitis B core antibody total negative. FibroScan was performed and is 15.0 kilopascals and therefore consistent with cirrhosis. And his hepatitis C RNA was 9.2 million international units per mil.
Individualizing treatment for a patient like this, what factors most influence your decisions?
Well, in general, we want to treat all patients with hepatitis C, but in some cases we feel more motivated or perhaps we feel that we need to proceed with a faster pace. And this patient here represents one of those times. So we know that the patients who have both HIV and hepatitis C are at greater risk for progression to cirrhosis, and they're at greater risk for the complications of cirrhosis. And so this patient here is already at that point, but let's say this patient was actually an earlier stage of liver disease. We'd still be very motivated to get this patient on treatment. And if the patient was reticent about treatment for some reason, we want to make sure that they understood the implications and why we want to proceed with the hepatitis C treatment. Now, this patient does have cirrhosis according to the FibroScan that was performed. Any value that's more than 12.5 in hepatitis C patients is a concern that they have reached the point of cirrhosis. And when you do have cirrhosis, then we want to make sure we understand where you are within that. And there's one group of patients we call compensated and another group that we call decompensated. Compensated means that if I were to biopsy your liver or look at it under a microscope, I would see the features of cirrhosis. But when I examine you and talk to you, you've not had any of the complications of liver disease. This is in contrast to someone with decompensated cirrhosis that does have some of those complications. So maybe they have ascites, or they've had hepatic encephalopathy, or they've bled from varices. Those patients have crossed a line and their liver is sicker. And that will impact how we think about their treatment and which treatments we might offer them.
And just for clarity, doctor, this patient is cirrhotic, but he has not shown any signs of decompensation. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
How would your approach be different if this patient was decompensated?
When a patient has decompensated cirrhosis, we need to think about if now's the right time for them to proceed with hepatitis C treatment, or do we need to think about a transplant evaluation? This is one of the current challenges for us in liver disease. And on the one hand, we don't have as many liver transplant programs offering transplants to HIV hepatitis C patients, but there are a number now around the country, and that is something that should be considered for each patient, and perhaps they are someone who's either near a center or might be interested in pursuing transplantation. If they're not either interested or are able to undergo liver transplantation, then we need to really think about treatment for them and make sure that we're doing right by them in that respect. Once they have reached that point of decompensated cirrhosis, the choices for some of their antiviral regimens for hepatitis C become more limited. This is particularly around those regimens that involve a protease inhibitor. These drugs are not recommended in patients who have advanced liver disease that includes decompensated cirrhosis. Often when you look at the package inserts, it'll talk about not being recommended in patients with Child's Pugh B or C, and it's a safety issue there. They get accumulation of the protease inhibitor and they're at risk for toxicity. So we'd be offering them the regimens that do not include protease inhibitors.
So then, If this patient is going to accept hepatitis C treatment, how would you alter his HIV regimen?
So when considering treatment for the hepatitis C in a patient who has co-infection with HIV and hepatitis C, it's really important to look at the HIV drugs. We know that there are a number of drug-drug interactions between the HIV meds and the hepatitis C agents. And we know to look for these things, and then we'll make the choices based upon what is eligible. Even within what's known about these drugs, there's still been some questions that came up out of the clinical trials about whether there still might be some issues between certain agents. This particularly came up for the efavirenz-containing regimens. The ION4 study was looking at sofosbuvir, ledipizivir in patients with HIV and hepatitis C. And one of the things they noticed was that all 10 of their relapses were African Americans, but 8 of these patients were receiving efavirenz-containing regimens. And so this was something that was still out there and a concern as the regimen entered clinical practice. But as we discussed in the newsletter, there was a nice report out of the Veterans Affairs Clinical Case Registry that looked at this very question and found that there really was no difference according to not only race there, but also whether or not the patient was on an efavirenz-containing regimen. So very nice there that our real-world data was supportive and helped resolve an issue that was still left over from the clinical trials. Another question that came up was whether or not there might be an issue with renal function for patients who are receiving tenofovir-containing regimens. And one of the concerns there is that ledipizivir will increase the level of tenofovir. And so the question was, would it be a concern? Would it somehow impact the safety and the renal function of the patients receiving that regimen? And again, our registry showed that it was safe, that was not a concern that was borne out. And I think that's given clinicians more confidence to offer this regimen to their patients who have HIV and are also on these tenofovir-containing regimens.
Comparing cure rates between patients who have hepatitis C alone and those who have HIV-HCV co-infection, what do the data show?
In the past, we would have told patients with HIV hep C that their chances of cure from hepatitis C treatment was lower than someone who just had hep C. But in the direct-acting antiviral era, we have found that the response rates are the same, essentially. So whether you have HIV hep C or hep C monoinfection, the results are the same. And I tell all patients that their chances of cure are around 95%. This is very powerful for patients to hear, and especially for these patients with HIV hep C to know that their chances of cure are just as great as somebody else's. It's been very powerful. It's also been extremely important and encouraging that these data were not only in clinical trials, but as these medications have come out into the real world, that our registries are showing this. The outcomes are the same, whether you're hep C monoinfected or HIV hep C. It's been really great.
I want to thank you, Dr. Muir, for today's cases and discussion. One more question for you, and it's about the near future. In the next year or so, what major developments might be expected in hepatitis C treatment?
It's very exciting that we're still having new regimens come out that are going to help us advance hepatitis C treatment further. One of the key things is we have a salvage regimen that is currently under FDA review. It is the current combination of sofosbuvir-velpatasvir, but with the addition of voxelaprevir, and that's a protease inhibitor. And where this will be important is for those people who failed one of our current therapies, that we now have something that has been shown in clinical trials that is very effective in that group as well. So again, for that very small percentage of people who failed the current strong therapies we have a therapy that looks that, again, over 90-95% of patients can be cured by that regimen. So it's given us more confidence to be able to tell patients that even if you happen to be one of the small number of people who fail a current treatment, we have something else coming for you. And that's very important to be able to share with patients. The other reason for enthusiasm is we have another pan-genotypic regimen coming. So this is glecaprevir, pribrentasvir, and this is, again, pan-genotypic, so covering all the major genotypes. And as discussed earlier in this podcast, this does not have significant renal clearance, and so will be available to all degrees of renal function, and particularly for that group of patients that currently may be recommended to get PEG interferon alpha and ribavirin. Now we're going to have an interferon-free, potent DAA regimen available. And so it'll be important to have yet another strong medication that's out there for patients with hepatitis C. So we're really seeing choices, and we're really seeing strong regimens. And again, this the importance of being able to offer every patient really the chance for cure their hepatitis C. It's been really great.
Well, thank you for sharing your insights, Doctor. Let's wrap things up now by reviewing today's discussion in light of our learning objectives. So to begin, the real-world data that support a sofosbuvir-ledipizivir treatment duration of 8 weeks versus 12 weeks.
Multiple real-world cohorts have demonstrated that 8 weeks of sofosbuvir-ledipizumab is reasonable for many patients with genotype 1 infection if they do not have cirrhosis and their HCV RNA is less than 6 million international units per mil. It's also important, though, that one key finding was a small but meaningful difference with lower SVR rates in African Americans. And as a result, there's been a recent update to the AASLD IDSA guidance panel that they do not recommend 8 weeks for African Americans and instead would recommend 12 weeks when using ledipizumab-sofosbuvir.
Our second learning objective, the current hepatitis C treatment options for patients with advanced kidney disease.
So the assessment of renal function is important for all patients, and all regimens are safe and well-tolerated if the GFR is more than 30 mL per minute. Sofosbuvir-containing regimens, however, cannot be recommended in patients with a GFR less than 30 mL per minute or if the patient is on dialysis. In the HCV target database, among patients with lower GFRs treated with sofosbuvir-containing regimens, serious adverse events were more than threefold higher, and worsening renal function was noted in those patients not on dialysis receiving these regimens. Patients with genotype 1 and 4 have multiple effective regimens without sofosbuvir available to them, but patients with genotypes 2, 3, 5, and 6, and low GFR have not had an interferon-free regimen available to them. But glecaprevir, pibrentazvir is expected to be available in late 2017 and will meet this need.
And finally, the risks and benefits of hepatitis C therapies in HIV-HCV co-infected patients.
Hepatitis C therapies are highly effective in patients co-infected with HIV-Hep C and in rates similar to mono-infected patients. Patients with HIV-Hep C on HIV antiretroviral therapy need review of potential drug-drug interactions when considering the various Hep C regimens. There was early concern about lower response rates in IN4 with sofosbuvir-ledipizumab for African Americans, and this raised the question of lower response on patients receiving efavirenz. But real-world studies have now shown no differences in SVR among African Americans or for those patients receiving efavirenz-containing regimens. These therapies have been safe and well-tolerated among patients with HIV-Hep C infection. In particular, there was concern that ledipizumab increased tenofovir exposure, but real-world studies have shown no changes in renal function during Hep C therapy.
Dr. Andrew Muir from Duke University School of Medicine, thank you for participating in this eViral Hepatitis Review podcast.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be with you. This is a great program, and it's really important to see how these agents have been working in the real world.
To receive CME credit for this activity, please take the post test at www.eviralhepatitisreview.org/test. This podcast is presented in conjunction with the eViral Hepatitis Review newsletter, a peer-reviewed literature review certified for CME CE credit, emailed monthly to clinicians treating patients with viral hepatitis. This activity has been developed for primary care physicians, gastroenterologists, infectious disease specialists, OBGYNs, physician assistants, nurse practitioners and nurses, and other clinicians diagnosing or managing patients with viral hepatitis. This activity has been planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements and policies of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, through the joint providership of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine is accredited by the ACCME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine designates this enduring material for a maximum of 0.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. The Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing is accredited as a provider of continuing nursing education by the American Nurses Credentialing Center's Commission on Accreditation. This 0.5 contact hour educational activity is provided by the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. Each podcast carries a maximum of 0.5 contact hour. This educational resource is provided without charge, but registration is required. To register to receive eViral Hepatitis Review via email, please go to our website, www.eviralhepatitisreview.org. The opinions and recommendations expressed by faculty and other experts whose input is included in this program are their own. This enduring material is produced for educational purposes only. Use of the names of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing implies review of educational format, design, and approach. Please review the complete prescribing information for specific drugs, combinations of drugs, or use of medical equipment, including indication, contraindications, warnings, and adverse effects, before administering therapy to patients. eViral Hepatitis Review is supported by educational grants from Gilead Sciences Incorporated, Merck & Company Incorporated, and AbbVie Incorporated. This program is copyright, with all rights reserved, by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing.